Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, September 26, 2014. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. As selected by two experts in the world of the federal government, this week my experts are Molly O'Neill, Vice President at CGI Federal and former Chief Information Officer at the Environmental Protection Agency. It's great to see you again, my friend. Thanks for coming in. If people only knew what we talked about before the countdown actually started, huh?
I think they'd laugh.
I think they would laugh profusely, but we're not going to go there. Thank you very much. You chose some great stories this week. I'm looking forward to talking about them. And after an unusually weirdly long hiatus on the Federal News Countdown, it's wonderful to see my friend Jonathan Bruhl, formerly the IBM Center for the Business of Government. Welcome back to the countdown. What are you doing now? I mean, you've retired from the IBM Center, and Dan Chenick unceremoniously pushed you out of his way clawed his way to the top of the IBM Center. I'm teasing about Dan. He's a great friend of the show. So what are you doing these days?
I'm teaching at Georgetown University. I'm doing a bunch of projects for NAPA, working also with Paul Posner at George Mason University.
So wonderful.
There's a whole bunch of things.
You're staying very busy, yeah. And it's great to see you. And you also have chosen terrific stories for the countdown this week. Can we start where we always do with
number three?
Molly O'Neill, your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from FCW.com. It's Colby Hockamuth's story, The Skinny on the White House's New Open Government Initiatives. A lot of these things have caused a little bit of turmoil in the contractor community, because one of the things Colby writes writes here is about the role that U.S. Digital Services team will play and 18F. USDS has not been as unsettling, I take it at least, for the contractor community as 18F was. But I remember when we first started learning about that, people in the contracting community just freaked out. Is that appropriate, do you think? And what do you think overall this open government stuff means for people that are trying to do ops inside government?
Well, I think contractors are going to have sort of an immediate reaction. This is new, and I'm not sure it's infringing upon my territory. Mm-hmm. I think that's okay, but I think there's a role for everybody in this place. And one of the things that I really liked, and one of the reasons I picked the story, is the focus on this is talking about the looking at customer experience and really highlighting that for the first time. And the digital service team and 18F are really going to be focused on there. Because if you think about contractors, get upset because they're builders usually, right? They're building systems to help digitize and get customer experience out there. The federal employees are trying to get their programs done. And sometimes you need an intermediary there that says, listen, if you do things the way you do things now, which is organized by how what you call things within the government and how you're organized or a statutory act or something, the regular general public does not think of things this way. And so what I like about this is it provides another voice into the process to sort of help negotiate really what regular citizens are looking for and what they call things and how they might search for things, mm-hmm. versus maybe how a contractor might be told to do something by, their government counterparts. And sometimes the government folks have just been there too long and know the program really well, but yet they're separated a little bit from the customer. And so this is one thing that I thought was really important to highlight coming out of this. And whether it actually happens in terms of implementation and whether people both sides either listen, mm-hmm. is another whole aspect of this we don't know. But
Jonathan,
the concept is good.
I came here about 8 years ago, and I remember starting here and knowing a little bit about how the executive branch operates, but being struck by the fact that so many people were focused on their program or their work and not the broader mission. And I have to say, in the last couple of months, but in the last year or 2 years overall, there's been almost a complete 180-degree turn. And I don't know what to attribute it to, whether it's the administration or whether it is just internal operations inside the agencies. But I'm seeing some agencies in particular and most agencies really thinking, what's the point of this? And what is the outcome that we want? And the end result being that we deliver a service better, or we serve a constituent or a customer in a certain way that we're not doing now, or whatever, instead of the point of this is to deploy a program or install, upgrade a website or something like that.
Well, some of this, I think, is due to just how long it takes anything in government to get done.
Mm-hmm.
You speak about 8 years. It's taken 20 years for the long-term focus on results to sink in. The customer service stuff began even longer than that with Al Gore, mm-hmm. and his crew. And the customer service may actually result in a bill. They may, in the lame duck session, be able to push that through. The bill was cleared through the House and got some traction in the Senate, so it may well get some attention. But it just takes that long for the government to take up these challenges and really, you know, it takes a generation almost for these things to be picked up and go somewhere.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Molly O'Neill, is from FCW.com, the skinny on the White House's new open government initiatives. Jonathan, your choice at number three is my colleague Emily Kopp's story on federalnewsradio.com, headline, Senate leaves Social Security's Colvin and others waiting for confirmation. But we had a chance to chat before the countdown began, all three of us, and you made a really good point that the story here is not necessarily just what Emily's writing, right?
Exactly. I mean, Carolyn Colvin has been waiting now for a while for confirmation. She had a hearing in August. The Senate committee has cleared her, but Congress left town without taking a vote. But she's not alone. There are folks over in Homeland Security. The place has been described as an abysmal working place, lack of morale. Before his confirmation, the secretary Jed Johnson was saying that the department faces a leadership vacuum of alarming proportions, and we've got now the same thing happening with the Justice Department. Eric Holder leaving now, announced that just yesterday. I mean, the problem of all these vacancies is a serious problem, and we've had it since the beginning of the administration, and it's only going to grow worse as the administration comes to an end.
And although we went through the whole thing, Molly, with the nuclear option and all of that stuff in the Senate, but not all of the problems exist in the Senate. I mean, Emily writes here, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration is one that she writes you can't blame on the Senate. President Obama hasn't nominated anybody to lead that. It's kind of hard to confirm somebody whose name isn't there. So it's a combination problem. The one with General Holder in particular, I think, is interesting, though, because he said, and I saw this distinction missed in a lot of media outlets, he's going to stay until his replacement is confirmed, not until his replacement is named. And, well, if he's going to stay until his replacement's confirmed, he might be here for the rest of the administration.
Oh, absolutely. I suspect there's already probably names floating, right? But it's really about how long the process takes. And Jonathan's right, though. You know, whether it's because someone's being held up, or whether it's the fact that people aren't being named, it means leadership decisions are not being made. And so there's stagnation between that and CRs and everything else. It really puts a hold down on government. And as Jonathan said earlier, it takes so long to get government to move on things, and then you have leadership challenges. It's a pretty significant problem.
And it strikes me too, Jonathan, that the tremendous complication here is the calendar. We're now
Absolutely.
2 years into President Obama's second term.
The clock's running.
I had a conversation just this week with somebody who's in this situation and thinking about the person who doesn't exist yet who would come in to replace her. And how do you, there's probably not going to be somebody.
Right.
It's probably going to be an acting career person for the rest of the term. Because how do you convince somebody to move to Washington who's not already in the administration, or to go through this holding pattern for who knows how long till they can get confirmed for a job they know they're going to be out of in January 2017?
Yeah, I think Holder is a rare case where there are enough opponents of his on the Hill that they'd probably be happy to move a replacement if he's going to stay there.
You know, that's something I hadn't considered,
right.
But I think that's exactly right. Enough of the members who could potentially put a hold on his successor want him out of there bad
exactly.
enough.
So that's
exactly.
a great strategy for the administration, right? I'm going to stay until someone's confirmed.
I hadn't thought of that, right, but that's a great way to look at it. Jonathan Brule's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is Emily Kopp's story on federalnewsradio.com titled Senate Leaves Social Security's Colvin and Others Waiting for Confirmation. All the stories from the countdown are at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important stories of the week from Molly O'Neill and Jonathan Brule on the Federal News Countdown. Be right back. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Molly O'Neill and Jonathan Brule, and we are up to
number two.
Molly O'Neill's second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline is the tide turning against federal telework? And it's almost like a too-good-to-be-true story, Molly. We seem to be at a tipping point where telework was finally firing on all gears, and we heard the success stories from various places, and then it's like the bottom fell out of it all at once, it seems.
Yeah, I agree. But I think one of the reasons I picked this story was because you can blame telework, but poor performers and people who are not producing are either sitting in an office or they're sitting at home. And so, you know, I speaking from my own experience, you know, you can see people who spend, who are reportedly there and doing time fraud charges, fraudulent charges, if they're sitting in the office and not doing work, right? Mm-hmm. What's the difference here? So the issue really to me is you can be doing it with an office or you can do it at telework. Fraudulent timekeeping is fraudulent timekeeping. It really is needs to be looked at, not just the time people are spending, but what the outcomes are here, which is part of what this is about. So you can have someone who spends 80 hours a week in the office. It doesn't mean they're producing anything.
The Patent and Trademark Office case that this story cites, Jonathan, is a little bit different. What Molly's talking about is very common across government, and telework people, telework advocates have been talking about that, I think, a lot more forcefully lately, that this is a performance problem and a management problem and not a technology or telework problem. The PTO issue is a little bit different because the I'm using air quotes, fraudulent timekeeping, according to the leader of the Postal Service or Patent and Trademark Office's Employees Association, he told me the issue was, he believes, more nuanced than that. PTO has very specific milestones that they have to hit. These employees were hitting their milestones and doing them in a lot less than 80 hours at a pay period, and yet they were still putting 80 hours a pay period on their time cards. So yes, by the letter of the law, they weren't being honest, but they were still meeting every single one of their workforce requirements. And so the issue becomes, it seems to me, not just a time card problem, but an expectations problem. Is it time to either turn up the volume and expect these people to process more cases, or it's a lot more complex than just this is somebody slacking off and spending 20 hours a week on Amazon instead of processing cases?
Yeah, we switch from one extreme to the other.
Right.
We want to focus on outcomes, and then we want to focus on process. And you can't have it. I mean, you in one sense you can have it both ways, but we've got to redefine what the work is supposed to be, and not let them drive it to this insane detail that's undercutting telework, and it's not helpful.
You can have it both ways if there's a balance between these two extremes, and
you've stated the outcome and which is most important.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, Molly, PTO said, we expect you as case processors to do this many, I think it was 11, in an 80-hour, two-week pay period. And everybody seemed to be doing that. And so the argument was, well, if we're meeting our goals and we're doing what's expected of us for each two-week period, what's the difference? And I think that's a pretty compelling argument that you can make, although I do see the other side of it that, hey, you said you worked 80 hours, you didn't work 80 hours. But this is one where there's a tremendous gray area here that nobody seems willing to address.
Absolutely. That's why this article is important. Mm-hmm. So it's important because it kind of it says, is it really telework? Well, no, that's really not the issue here. Like I said, those people could have done 40 hours and did it in the office, right? Same thing. What it's doing is exposing the fact that, what do we want to be? Do we want to do butts and seats for 8 hours in government service, or do we want to focus on the outcomes? And how do we bridge the gap as we transition into more outcome-based things? Because it is a good argument.
Well, and the PTO is arguing, in fact, that the IG has documented that there are they're producing, 3.5 more applications per year. I mean, so they actually were producing more when they were under a teleworking scheme.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I don't know how
Are they producing more, and are they of good quality, right?
Well,
right.
Presumably they were of quality, too.
Exactly.
I mean, for the IG to put his mark on it.
I mentioned the union. Robert Budin's the president of the Patent Office Professional Association, who was on the show. It's been 3 weeks or a month now. That's at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Wrote in a blog post also, examiner's time is tracked to six-minute intervals, tenth of an hour. And the performance appraisal plans at PTO require accountability for examiner's time by assigning a certain number of hours to do a case for each examiner based on the particular technology being examined and the experience and authority of that examiner. Now, he told me in that interview, he's perfectly open as the leader of the union to having a conversation about what the expectations are. They want to cooperate with PTO because they understand the value of the telework program, and they don't want that to be endangered. So if we're moving this to more cases that we're expected to process, great.
Right.
We can talk about that. It strikes me that referring this to the Justice Department, as Chairman Issa would like to do, might be overkilling it a little
bit. And not very helpful.
Yeah, doesn't wind up with the result that you want. The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Molly O'Neill, is from NextGov, is the tide turning against federal telework. Jonathan, your choice at number two this week is from the Washington Post. New details in fence jumping reveal failures in security rings around the White House. And if I know you as much as I think I know you, you and I went the same place when we first heard about this story. When this broke, I was listening to WTOP. Dave McConnell, our Capitol Hill correspondent, was actually at the White House when this was happening and was calling in from there. And the first place I went to was, oh no, Secret Service under the microscope again after having a rough last year or so.
Yeah, they've had nothing but trouble, particularly for off-duty behavior and call girls in Columbia and so forth. But this time, this is right on the White House lawn.
Yeah.
And right in the president's backyard. And the slip-up was egregious, from the plainclothesman outside the gate to the plainclothesman in the booth inside, the attack dog not being released, the SWAT team not being available. There was no one guarding the door, and the door was wide open. And finally, I guess he was subdued by a plainclothes agent who was guarding the inside of the mansion.
This story says the sixth ring of security finally got him.
Right.
It's amazing. I think back. I read a book about President Lincoln not too long ago. And when he was president, you could just walk into the White House
right.
and see the president. I mean, this is after what I'm just counting off the top of my head, five presidential assassinations between then and now, maybe more because I might have forgotten one. And it's 2014 and all the dangers of the world as it exists today. And this guy cuts five rings of security. This story quotes a former high-ranking Secret Service official speaking on the condition of anonymity. One after another unit failed. This guy has now crossed some 70-some yards of restricted area. If he has a device on him and he gets in, he controls the White House. He could have anything on him. So the failure here of a high-level, not very public, but somewhat well-known to the general public government organization, Molly, this is the way that I think is most constructive to look at this from the people who sit in the kinds of world that we sit in, that we live in. What do we do with this? This knowledge is important to have, but really unpleasant to think about.
Yeah, I think in particular having that news come out this week, when I think security is, most Americans think security is heightened, and to have this lapse, I think, is something that provides a little bit of fear, but it also is is it a wake up call, right, in terms of how we need to make sure that we are all in heightened awareness and that jobs are being done and fulfilled, and you know, how do we measure so that it doesn't get to the sixth or seventh ring of security? So it does raise a lot of concerns.
Police also found a map of the Washington area with a circle around the Masonic Temple in Alexandria and a line that pointed toward the White House. Number of weapons in his car. Didn't have anything on him but a folding knife that, when I think of a folding knife, I think of like a Swiss Army knife or pocket knife or something. I mean, you could hurt somebody, but...
But it really raises the question of sort of the rules of engagement. I mean, at what point are you going to shoot at somebody like this?
Mm-hmm.
And do you shoot to kill? Do you shoot to wound? Do you have other, you know, devices like shocks or something to bring him down? But nothing was done to engage this guy. And it's just flabbergasting that this is, that someone was able to get this far.
This can't end with anything but a stem to stern review of the Secret Service, can it?
And maybe a replacement and maybe an outside director. I mean, this is taken the Keystone Cops routine just too far, and it's not a funny matter.
Jonathan Bruhl's second most important federal news story of the week's from the Washington Post. New details in fence jumping reveal failures in security rings around White House. You can find it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news stories of the week when we come back with Jonathan Bruhl and Molly O'Neill on Federal News Radio. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Jonathan Bruhl and by Molly O'Neill, and we are up to
number one.
Molly O'Neill's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. It's Charlie Clark's story headlined, Army's Doctrine Chief Says, Expect the Unexpected. And this is a theme that I am starting to see in a lot of the conversation that is coming from the military, the uniformed side of the Defense Department and the administration. I'm not seeing it much from the policy and the civilian side of the administration, but that is that who knows what's next? The world is increasing in complexity exponentially, and we can't even begin to figure out what the next thing might be that throws a monkey wrench into our plan. Here's the quote, Molly, that got to me. General David Perkins speaking at the Stimson Center. Who knew a year ago we'd have thousands of troops in Africa fighting the Ebola virus while we're also fighting ISIS? Now, we learned this week also that not only are we fighting ISIS and not only are we fighting Al-Qaeda, but there's a splinter group of Al-Qaeda called the Khorasan that unless you've really been paying attention to this stuff, we didn't know about until this week. So expecting the unexpected means to me, this is whatever we're involved in has the potential to be a lot longer, a lot harder, and a lot more complex than it looks on the surface. Am I reading this right, according to what you saw General Perkins saying here?
Yeah, and I think the other quote that I liked in this article was, the tendency is to turn things into a seven-year-old soccer game in which everyone's going after the ball. Some of us need to think ahead, in other words. And I think the point there is, here, these things come up, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden now we're going to take people, and we've been maybe cutting down on training and thinking and innovation and everything else, and then we're just going to throw people at it, right? And that's mm-hmm. why the people you're hearing through, people actually, you know, in uniform are concerned, right? But keeping up with these things that we don't even know require a lot of thinking, and it requires a lot of innovation, and it requires a lot of access to new things. And it's really not about throwing resources. It's about planning all along and being intelligent all along about these things that might come up. So mm-hmm. to me, I picked out that quote from the article and the last one because that was kind of scary, right? Uh-huh. Just throw people at it, right? Yep. But we don't even know what to expect that we're throwing at.
Well, and that having not too long ago, I guess about 6 or 7 years ago, had a 7-year-old soccer player, that analogy makes a lot of sense because everybody on the whole field is focused on that ball and they're all around the ball and there's nobody on the rest of the field. Jonathan, I was on a radio show this week outside of the Washington, D.C. area as a guest where the host asked me, whatever happened to the rebalance to the Pacific? The focus on what was going on in the Asia-Pacific region, and we were going to focus resources and time and effort there. And I said, well, obviously, it appears to the national security experts that I'm talking to here in town, what happened was the Middle East exploded and caught fire. That's what happened to the rebalance. And this concept that General Perkins is talking about here shouldn't be foreign to any of us. And I think it's somewhat troubling that he feels obligated to bring it up.
Well, and it's particularly a problem in DOD because it shouldn't be foreign there.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in the domestic agencies, though, it has really become a very serious problem because people think thinking strategically is a GPRA 5-year plan, when in fact it's thinking what's going to happen in the year 2025 to 2030. The Air Force has been complaining about this, that they're having a sort of a short-term budgetitis that they're talking about and trying to think long-term. The Social Security Administration has a major effort to think long-term, and it's unclear whether the union and the rest of the employees there are going to have enough gumption to really face up to thinking long-term, but no one is taking a long-term view, and it's a serious problem.
Your OMB experience is showing, Jonathan, because I went the same place, or was going to go the same place that you just started to go. How much of this is because of the budget cycles that we're under and the way that the agencies are forced to think because of the way Congress forces them to think?
It isn't even just the Congress. The administration does not want to give long-term budget forecasts. We don't have 5, 10, and multi-year budgeting. We only forecast 1 year.
Is that something we used to have and don't anymore? Or is
absolutely
that...
yes. And we because we assume that we'll deal with tomorrow's problem tomorrow. Today's the only problem and the only budget problem we're going to deal with. So again, people have really gotten caught up in this budgetitis. And of course, with CRs and all the rest of the things we have this in the last few years, it's even been less than 1 year that people have been only worried about the next. Next continuing resolution and whether they're going to have the money to deal with the bills and pay the employees and contractors for tomorrow and not long term.
I read something else between the lines of this story, Molly, that General Perkins didn't come right out and say at Stimson, but that I kind of take away from it anyway. The military leaders... this is just the latest in an effort by them to be much more specific about how they see the future. They see, the military leaders that I've had the fortune to know are not only skilled at matters of war. They're skilled in politics, too. You don't rise to the top of an operation like a branch of the military by not being so. And so it's just my sense that General Dempsey, and in this case, General Perkins and some of the others, understand that they only will be dealing with this administration for 2 more years, and that they have problems that they're trying to think through, as General Perkins says here, thinking toward 2025. And they're starting to do that even if nobody else is willing to at this point, or at least if they perceive no one else is willing
to. Yeah, that could be. I mean, certainly if I were in their shoes, I'd be thinking the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of the last 2 years of administration, now is the time to kind of talk out. But I also think it's because, listen, they've been dealing with this for so many years. And, you know, they're seeing the problems. And every year we think, okay, we're going to disinvest in this. And so we're going to pull money away. And then, oh, something else comes up. And it's just shooting at rabbit holes here, right? And so there's probably a little bit of frustration just in terms of not just the fact that you got 2 years and this is the time to do it from a sort of political standpoint, mm-hmm. political savvy standpoint to do it in a nice way, right, to educate mm-hmm. Folks out there. But also, I think it's also sort of a building. If you think about it, we haven't had budget. We haven't had anything since, 2009 or 8? I can't remember, Jonathan. A real budget to deal with, to do any forecasting and planning. So it's probably a little bit of both.
We can't bank on that delta being there, the longtime technological advantages that the United States has had. That's one message of unity that I hear, because Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary for Acquisition Technology and Logistics, has been out there saying that now for a couple of months. And that should be, I hope that's a little bit frightening to members of Congress, that you have that message that both the military and civilian leaders of the Pentagon agree on, that the United States is losing that. Because General Perkins says in this story, Jonathan, to win without a fight, we must be able to win a fight. You know, if you go in with that advantage ahead
right.
of time, makes it a whole lot easier
whole
to
lot
get
easier.
Out of there.
Right.
What do we do with this all across government, this idea of expecting the unexpected in managing in environments where we're not going to be facing another adversary militarily, but where a huge storm may come along that my agency has to deal with, or some kind of epidemic or some other catastrophic event that can't be forecast or predicted?
Well, you've named them, and they affect every domestic agency.
Mm-hmm.
Social Security was... thrown for a real loop when Hurricane Katrina came. They had recipients from the Delta who moved up to Missouri. They had people out of their homes. So again, every agency's got to expect the unexpected and anticipate and plan on having major disruptions in what they do. They may be disruptions of a good kind. They may be disruptions of a bad kind. They may be technology. They may be human, but they need to plan on them.
Is it your sense that agencies are doing a sufficient job of examining and updating COOP plans and really preparing for whatever might happen next?
I guess, fortunately, I don't know, but I would guess not. Those probably are not, and those are more mechanical in one sense. I mean, what you're talking about is, in some cases, long-term planning. What's the world going to be like in the year 2025?
Vision stuff,
yes,
not mechanical.
And that's hard to do, and there aren't many people who are good at it. There are several visionaries that make a trade of it, but thinking that through and what will affect their mission and what they're going to do about it, and preparing them then for budgets and recruiting people who are in the next generation. These are all things that are solid day-to-day management, but they're just being ignored because of the exigency, really, of quarterly and less budgets that are driving people to short-termitis.
Molly O'Neill's most important federal news story of the week's from GovExec. The headline is, Army's Doctrine Chief Says Expect the Unexpected. You can find it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. Jonathan Brule's choice for number one. We'll wrap up this week's federal news countdown next on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Molly O'Neill and Jonathan Brule. And Jonathan, your choice at number one. Thank heavens we can end on a high note this week, because there is some stuff going on that's not that great, and there is some stuff going on in government that is absolutely spectacular. Your choice at number one is from federalnewsradio.com, my colleague Michael O'Connell's story, headline, Partnership Named CDC Team, Federal Employee of the Year. And this is a story about the SAMMYs that the Partnership for Public Service puts on every year. I was very pleased to see you there. Were you there, Molly?
I was not there. Not this year.
We missed seeing you. You've been there before, though. Mm-hmm. But I came away from this event last year, the first one I went to do, Jonathan, telling folks at the Partnership, every year that you invite me, I'll be there. I will never miss another one if I can possibly help it, because there's so many layers to why this was a great event and why the people that are there are recognized for the work that they've done. They're doing ridiculously
things.
Spectacular things with almost zero recognition, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's out of the spotlight. People don't realize it, but it's the SAMMYs are called the Service to America Medals, and it's really a first-class award that showcases the talent and the dedication of a remarkable group of civil servants. I could describe them endlessly, but, Omar Perez and Reginald France, they were part of an IG law enforcement team called the Miami Heat,
mm-hmm.
and they dealt with Medicare fraud and phony Medicare durable medical equipment supplies and home health care charges by lots of agencies, and they saved billions, literally billions of dollars that went back to the Treasury. There were two young guys, Sean Young and Ben Tran from the Air Force Research Lab, who developed an aerial sensor that's protecting American soldiers from IEDs in Afghanistan. There are guys like William Bauman and Ann Spungen who come from the Bronx, where they're there with a VA medical hospital, and they're improving the lives of disabled vets who have spinal cord injuries. The list is endless. The winners exemplify the solid work effort and creativity that enables our government to achieve unbelievable successes.
The one that I recall, because I talked to two of these people, I was so pleased, Molly, to talk to a bunch of these people throughout the course of the year and meet them and learn their stories on the program. But the ones, the category that really hammered me over the head at this event this year was the call to service. Now, these are people who are 35 and under, and so they're at, you would think, at the beginnings of their federal careers. Two of the guests that I had on the program were in that category. One of them was Sophia Hussein from the Securities and Exchange Commission. She's based in Boston, and she investigates Ponzi schemes and returned about $500 million to people who had been victimized by Ponzi schemes. The other one was a gentleman who's, I'm sorry his name escapes me, but he works on rocket programs in the Air Force and saved, I believe his number was $4 billion in negotiations with contractors on rockets, satellite launches for the Air Force. Jonathan's got his program there.
Jonathan Baker.
Thank you. That's exactly who it was. Yeah. And neither one of them won. They were finalists and didn't get it because Sarah Myers at HUD, director of the Sandy Program Management Office, got it because of the way that she ran the Hurricane Sandy response effort for Secretary Donovan, who's now, by the way, you know, good
director
career move
Roman.
On her part,
yeah.
Because her boss, who was there to congratulate her, is now the director of the Office of Management and Budget. So I mean, but you do what those two people did, and you don't win.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable to me.
That's great. I mean, I love ending today's with these stories, because we do sometimes talk about all the things and the challenges of, mm-hmm. of working for the federal government and the challenges that make it hard to work. But yet every day, you know, there are people who are actually doing really, really good work with a lot of challenges around them. And people don't always hear these stories. That's why I think the Sammies are fantastic, because we got to get these stories out, because yeah. that will show people that the government actually does great work, and young people who are also having an impact too, right?
I was struck, Jonathan, by the amount of times, and it might have been everybody, I didn't keep track, but the amount of times that people on that podium Monday night said, I'm accepting this for, or on behalf of,
absolutely.
Or whatever. I don't recall anybody who said, thanks for this because I got it.
No, there's no solo players here. These were all big team efforts, and they all recognized that they were part of a team. The other factor that really amazes me and has particularly over the years is the number of immigrants who are also or kids who are, you know, Ben Tran, for example, is from
his parents from Vietnam.
Vietnam. I mean, so you know, the diversity and youth in this crowd is really remarkable.
Dr. Rana Hajjeh, the Federal Employee of the Year from Lebanon.
From Lebanon.
You know, all she did, Molly, was save the lives of 7 million kids between now and 2020. That's all she
did. That's all she
did. And over 9 years, she worked with 60 countries to bring them together.
Yeah.
So they would begin to adopt this vaccine to deal with
little program.
And she's saving the lives of 7 million kids by the year 2020.
It's
tremendous. It's just amazing.
I congratulated Tim McManus of the partnership on the program yesterday on behalf of everybody there. I told him to pass along the congratulations, because it's amazing stuff. And we have details on all the Sammies, the finalists and winners, at federalnewsradio.com. Dr. Hajjeh was on the federal drive with Tom Temin on Tuesday morning, the night after she won, and congratulations to her. The thing that I think is the most exciting is they'll do them again next year.
Absolutely.
And we'll have another pile like this next year. We just have about 30 seconds left, Jonathan. The disconnect here is the perception of most people is that the federal government's not capable of this kind of thing. What changes that, do you think, if anything, at this point? Or is it a lost cause?
I don't know. I mean, I've been to every one of the SAMI events, and I've come away with the same feeling you have. But then I, upon second thought, wonder, how do we get this word out, and how do we have it make a difference? And it just doesn't seem to penetrate.
We'll keep hammering away. What a terrific conversation I've had with you guys. Thank you very much for coming in. Molly O'Neill, great to see you as always, my friend.
Good to see you.
And Jonathan Brule,
yes,
thank you very much for doing it. The Federal News Countdown is on federalnewsradio.com later this afternoon. All the stories that we talked about are archived there for you to read anytime you want. And the Federal News Countdown is back next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose.